Thank you, Mom, for that beautiful, inspiring talk. You flatter us here in Singapore. We have now another beautiful speaker with us. She's Nayaswami Asha. She's from the Ananda Center in Palo Alto in the U.S. She's been a devotee of Paramahansa Yogananda. Does anybody want to guess? Paramahansa Yogananda is our guru. Does anybody want to guess how long she's been a devotee? Any numbers? 10 years? 15 years? 13, 25. I heard 13, 25.
50 years?
Did someone say 50? Yes! Spot on! She's, yes. She's been a lifelong devotee. She first walked in to meet Swami Kriyananda, who's a direct disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda, and she was only 22 years. And she stayed on ever since. 50 years, half a century. It's amazing. She has more than 800 YouTube videos, and these videos are like the Bible for people who want to know more about Paramahansa Yogananda's teachings. So I'm not going to say much more about her, because I'll be holding on her from, you know, coming up and giving us a beautiful talk. I can keep going on and on. So Ashaji, please, may we have you on stage?
It's great. It's a great honor to be here with you today. This trip to Singapore was first contemplated when I met Yogi from Singapore, who's the leader of the local center, in the kitchen of the ashram in Gurgaon, India, probably about 7 or 8 years ago. He was there visiting someone else, and I was there visiting someone else, and it was suggested that I should come to Singapore. But that was delayed until today, so I'm very glad to be here now. Kavita made a big deal about how many years I've been on the spiritual path. I whispered to Jamal, all that means is that I didn't die. Those of you who are not 25 understand that time simply passes, and after a while it accumulates. And those numbers seem big. When I was 22, 50 years seemed really big. And now that I'm 72, it's just like, there it is. This is what happens. But I'm not blind to the fact that I was very, very, very fortunate. There hasn't been a day in my life when I haven't appreciated what it means to know who you are and what you're doing spiritually. Of course, there's many aspects of life, and we all go through many cycles. We want to know why we were born. We want to know who's going to love us. We want to know what our talents are and how we're going to express them. We worry about our physical health. We want the people that we love to stay in place, whether that means with us or living or whatever it is. Life seems to be this big effort to get everything in order, and when we finally get it in order, to have it not change. One of the earliest things that I remember Swami Kriyananda saying, and I'll go back and talk a little about how I came to meet him, was most people don't want things to change. Change is the only reliable thing that will happen in this world. Therefore, most people are unhappy. And I contemplated that a great deal when I heard him say it, and I have never stopped thinking about it, because if you continue living, you see a lot of change. And every time one of those changes come, and the heart says, no, 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 and the world says, I don't care what you think, and it happens anyway, then we get challenged yet one more time, in the ways that Jamal was speaking of, which is the fundamental two impulses of all sentient beings. Whether it's a worm, a snail, or an astrophysicist, we desire to escape suffering, we desire to have more of joy, However we define that, we want more of what we feel gives us happiness and ease, and we want less of what we feel takes that away. I was born into a Jewish family in El Paso, Texas. For those of you who are familiar with America, Texas is not California. Texas has become quite a bit more enlightened since I was born there. Not because I was born there or because I left, but it was not the most inspiring environment to be part of. My father had been in the U.S. Army and ended up stationed there, and by the time he was released from the Army, the family was settled. These things happen. And then it took him a few years to organize himself and us to get to California while I was still in high school. But wherever I was from the very beginning, I subscribe entirely to the idea that this is not my first incarnation and is not likely to be my last. That the jiva that is me has had many life experiences. So we're not born with a clear slate. We're born turning the page and just simply continuing whatever karma is not resolved. And I was, from my earliest memories, a truth seeker. And I remember having a slightly problematic relationship with my dear and lovely, wonderful, loving mother, because when my mother was prejudiced emotionally towards someone or some things, she made up reasons to make that the truth. She wasn't entirely objective and honest, because if she wanted something to be true, she would assert that it was true. I remember being like 3 or 4 years old and becoming very suspicious of her advice because of that. I'm certain that I was quite a trial to my parents. But in any case, I was a truth seeker always. And when I looked at life, I don't even remember starting with this thought. I just remember it always was there. It seemed to me the whole point of the whole thing was how to avoid suffering and to have more of happiness. And I was gifted in school, which is something I believe I brought over from past lives. It was effortless for me to be good in school. And as a consequence, it was meaningless to me to be good in school. And it actually made me very nervous because I got an enormous amount of praise for being good in school, and I knew that I was doing nothing to accomplish that. And I wanted to understand what it was to be happy, and they wanted me to get A's on my reports. My parents had higher values than just external, but the world around me seemed to be disinterested in what seemed to me the only thing that mattered. And as a child, I decided that maybe all the adults around me actually knew this secret, but I wasn't quite old enough to be brought in. And being Jewish, at the age of 13, there's a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah for girls or boys. And I thought maybe as part of the bar mitzvah service, they would all take you into another room and say, ha ha, big joke, here's the secret of happiness. Everything else was just, you know, sort of stuff that was going on. But first when my brother, older brother, was bar mitzvah, and I realized that nobody told him, it began to dawn on me, and this was very terrifying, that they didn't know. That they were just following what seemed obvious, which was, you know, ethical, moral, loving. You know, I was gifted to be in a very nice family, to grow up in a very nice way. There was nothing wrong with what they were doing, which actually made it worse. Because it was like, is this it? Is this really what life is about? That I'm just supposed to use this brain that I've been given and go on to university and get higher degrees and become this and this? But I had this agonizing feeling that I was standing at the beginning of a very long road. And of course now I think about reincarnation as part of the explanation. But I could feel that I could take any one of those roads, and at the end of my life, where I was standing would not be what I wanted. It wouldn't be bad, it just wouldn't be enough. So in a very quiet way, you know, 14, 15, 16 years old, I functioned, I was not unbalanced, but I was terrified, I think is the only way I can put it. I was terrified that I would never break through the limitation that I could see around me. I remember being 10 years old, and we lived in a suburban area. We were still in Texas at that time, at a big picture window, and there were houses one by one next to each other, and across the street like this, and over here, right? No, it was over here, it was over there. The man there was mowing his lawn with this little electric mower like they do in America. I don't know what the... I don't see the same kind of lawns in Singapore. I don't think we have as much land as we have in Texas. But anyway, they were mowing the lawn. I remember just staring at him, Mr. Somebody, I can't remember his name now, thinking if I looked hard enough at him mowing the lawn, then some of the veil would remove, and I would see the reality behind it. And I remember conducting the scientific experiment to see if I could just pierce it, and being profoundly disappointed when I couldn't. So life moves on. I start in at university. I find I was at Stanford, which at that time had a high reputation. It's not. Now it's where God himself dwells, but at that point it was just a good school. But in any case, I got into that kind of school because that's who I was. In 2 weeks, I realized that they didn't know. They just didn't know. And I became very, even more frightened. Now, there's a rule of life, which is when you radiate a strong enough force, this is what Jamal was talking about, you put out enough force, the universe will answer you. And if you persevere in your focused determination, you will magnetize, the molecules of the universe will come together and will bring you the answer if you are deeply, sincerely calling in that way. So, November 1969, I was 22 years old. A friend of mine met a disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda who was an American man who had an Indian name, Swami Kriyananda, but his parents were from Oklahoma. He grew up in Europe, but he was an American man. He was 44, and my friend said, he's a real teacher, and I think you'll like him, which is probably the truest words that were ever spoken to me. And so I went, as it happened, there was a fraternity at Stanford that had a big tent in the back of their fraternity house because they were a big party fraternity and their house was too small for the parties that they held. It was the 60s in America, in California, which was a big changing time. It was big hippies and all of that, and I was right in the front of all of that. And somebody thought it'd be fun to have this Swami, you know, it was just like a weird new thing that was happening. And so they invited him into this party. They sort of thought it was some kind of a party. There was music playing and it was a big raucous. I mean, nothing like the atmosphere that you would expect. And I was with people who were a little leery of this whole thing. And so they had us sit in the farthest back row, I mean, with our backs against the wall. They wanted to be as far from this guy as they could possibly be. And he walked into the room, and he was very young and vigorous at that time. I mean, only a few of you have ever met him. The last decade of his life, he died when he was 85, 86, and he was quite frail. But when I met him, he was powerful, half my age now, virtually, and very strong. He just strode into that room. He didn't say a word. And I saw, for the first time in my life, I saw what I wanted to be. I mean, I don't know where that intuition came from. I don't actually even know what I was looking at. Later on, I came up with a few explanations for it. But I did have this perception. I had this perception that he was everywhere. Whereas most of us are just sort of in some close relation to this. Jamal was talking about that aura camera, and I know that camera, and I've done the same experiments that Jamal did. When Swami Kriyananda wanted to know about these cameras, they happened to be manufactured near the place where I live in California, and I went over to the manufacturer's place, and I met the delightfully kind of eccentric scientist who invented them, and we sat with these things, and I sat right in front of the camera. Actually, they were running video at that time. And I watched my aura change, and then I started to meditate, and I watched my aura turn, I didn't watch it, but I saw it after, it just turned white. And then I saw someone come into my aura, and I saw that he had a particular color, and that color began to affect me. And when we interacted, they take pictures with that aura camera, they take pictures of couples who are fond of each other kissing, and watch the aura shift. I mean, the camera's just, I don't know what it teaches us, but is it fun? It is such fun. You know, you can have a healer put his or her hands on you, and you'll watch your aura change colors. But in any case, coming back to this, there was something I could feel in Swamiji. I was starting to say that all of us in some way live in relationship to this physical body, because we're attached to it, we're defined by it. Only occasionally do we ever spin out of it. People have now these near-death experiences where they have this strange realization that what I call myself is only incidentally engaged in this. I read about I met a man recently who is a paleontologist who studies around the Arctic Circle. And he was in the Arctic Circle way up in the north in the cold, and a sudden storm came. And whenever you're out there doing this kind of field work, you always carry a big loaded shotgun, because there are a lot of bears who would happily eat you. You're easier to eat than a lot of other things that are up there. And so they always have a loaded shotgun, he said, because your life depends on it. So this big storm comes in, there's a lot of fog. That means he can't see any of these bears that might be coming to him, and he's in great danger of freezing to death. So he's rather scared, standing on the ice, and he said for no reason that he can understand, he suddenly popped out of his body and went, he described it, to the foyer of heaven, because he didn't feel like he was dying, he just feels like he was on holiday from his body. And later he was able to calculate that he was out of his body for about 2.5 hours. And during which time he was some 40 or 50 feet, he felt like his perspective was 40 or 50 feet above. And he saw this cold, shaking, scared something clutching a loaded shotgun. And he was, and the thing down there was so unhappy. And the self up here kept wanting to tell him, don't worry, it's going to be fine. But he wasn't able, so he just had to watch that poor one just be so nervous, while he himself just lived in this wonderful universe of what he called, of course, pure love, pure freedom, pure joy. Now, all of these words were not present in my mind in November of 1969. By that point, I had begun to understand that I wanted to expand, was the words that I had. And so I had decided that I would have a dozen children, because that seemed like that would make me bigger. You know, if I was only one and then I had 12 others or however random number. It's not a very practical idea, but that's the idea that I had. It would make me bigger. And then I had this terrible realization that merely conceiving and giving birth to children would not in itself make me a better person. And that was very distressing, extremely distressing, because somehow I had gotten in my mind that the mere fact of bearing a child would make me a good person. And I was sort of caught in all of that. And then when Swami came in, I realized that confinement, being confined, was what was oppressing me so much. And what was confining me, I gradually came to understand, was my self-definitions. That I defined myself as needing these things, as being afraid of change, of needing, and I was, relatively speaking, a high-functioning, really well-balanced person. We're not talking about somebody who's cowering in a corner, you know, drinking wine every morning. I was doing it. So it wasn't that I was ill, it's that I was a well person, but I could sense that there was something called being super well. And I just knew it was there, and then it walked into the room. It just walked into the room. Someone who wasn't confined in the way I was confined. And I already knew about Paramahansa Yogananda, I had been awakened to the idea of self-realization, to the teachings of India. It was part of that whole 60s movement that I was moving in. That's why Kriyananda was in the room in the first place. But I could read all of this, but I couldn't figure out how to get from where I was in actuality to where these great souls told me I could be. And when I first read Autobiography of a Yogi, it's very devotional. Yogananda, he loves God, he loves God, his Divine Mother. It, of course, comes from an Indian context where the feeling of a greater reality, you don't have to fight to explain it. In America, where we're very materialistic, you know, you have to fight to explain it. And Americans especially, being shrewd is a quality that Americans are very proud of. We don't like to be taken advantage of. We don't like to be made fools of. So even though Americans have a strong intuitive heart and a very loving nature, it was a joke in America that when we were engaged in the effort to get a person on the moon, it was suggested that the best way for America to succeed in landing on the moon was to send a poor dog up there and land him on the moon without a way to bring him home. And the entire country would unite to get the dog home. And it's true, or was true. Country shifting a little, but it was true. But at the same time, we always like to appear to be on top of it. You know, I love seeing America from the outside. But that's how we are. So there's a lot of spirituality, a huge amount of spirituality in America, but we didn't trust our intuition a lot. We always have to stand back and reanalyze it. Now that is actually a characteristic of our time. It's not just in my country. But in India, it's assumed that we are part of a greater reality. So Yogananda could write his book in the context of that culture, where there are saints, where there are gurus, where there are mysterious things happening in the Himalayas, where miracles can take place, where great souls can materialize because their disciples need them. I read about 8 pages of autobiography. I think it's on page 8 or maybe page 9 that some great yogi materializes in a wheat field in order to instruct his disciples. And I thought, no thank you. And I just closed the book and put it down. Considering the importance that it has later assumed in my life, isn't it interesting? I couldn't see it. As eager as I was, I couldn't see it. It was too far outside of where I was standing. But when Swami Kriyananda walked into the room with his unaccented English, which was pleasant for me, and his whole demeanor, which was just like, I recognized it, but he was not confined. And I was there up in the last row, and when he talked, he was right here. And he was right here because he was just going through me. It wasn't like he reached as far as me, it was just like his aura, if there had been a camera to take it, was just shifting, going right through the walls. It had no boundary. And I thought, that's freedom and that's what I want. I didn't even know anything about him. Turns out he was a disciple of Yogananda. And as a consequence, I read Autobiography of a Yogi and thought it was a terrific book. You know, I couldn't even remember why I had all the trouble with it that I had in the first place. Everything is perspective, isn't it? You know, we think, even scientists, everybody thinks we're being objective, but everything runs through this filter, like my mother, of our own emotions. And then we see it the way we see it. And then our self-definitions hold us, just like that. And at some point, we asked a very scientific question. How is this working for me? And is there an alternative? So now we are, you know, and as a consequence of that experience, Swami Kriyananda was starting an ashram community up in the mountains near Lake, in the hills of California. Took me a little bit of time to get myself organized. But in June of 1971, I moved from San Francisco, where I was living, up to this very primitive, extremely primitive, hardly there at all, big expanse of country land. And we just started in building a community. And we started in learning a new way of life. And I thought I was just going to sort of hang out in the woods for the rest of my life. I was really keen on just hanging out in the woods for the rest of my life. I have just washed my hands of everything. And I got to do that for like about 10 years. But then I quickly began to realize something which has also been the other absolute driving reality of my life, which is I really wanted to help people. But the problem was I was an idiot, and what could I give them? You know, I didn't know anything that I really thought was worth giving. That was part of the reason I thought, well, I'll at least raise children. Maybe I can raise good children. But I really wanted to help people, but I didn't know any truth to give them. So, of course, once I started seriously trying to gain mastery over myself, and you see what I began to understand is what Jamal was talking about today. I am not at all scientific. Jamal gave me that science word that he said really big. Even now I can't remember it. I said it about 10 times in the hope that I can remember it because I thought it was such a nifty word. Even now I can't remember it. I did grasp the basic concept, but I still can't say it. But what I began to understand is exactly what he was describing. It's not random. You know, I'm not just a random piece of fluff that's just being blown around this world by forces that I can't see and I don't understand. There is such a thing as karma. There is such a thing as karmic patterns that we carry in our chakras. There is a relationship between what we think and what happens to us. And infinitely more important than all of that is it's not random. That there are specific, identifiable ways in which we can influence, I mean, not only our destiny in a great arc, but the way you feel when you wake up in the morning. I mean, this was what I'd been asking for ever since I was 3 years old, which is there must be a way to be happy. There must be a scientific way to avoid suffering and to find happiness. Now, the problem, of course, with all of this is that it's simple, but it's not easy. And because it's not easy, we think it's complicated. Because partly as long as it's complicated and we can't understand it, we don't actually have to do it, do we? We can just talk about it, we can contemplate it, we can argue about it, you know, whatever we can do, but we don't actually have to do anything about it. And I began to realize that one of the differences between me, well, my 1 year that I was at college, was very interesting to me. I lived in this dorm with all these other women, and so many of them were really unhappy, just on a kind of existential level that was very difficult to grasp. It's much worse now, but the pressure for gifted college students to meet some external standard even then was very intense. And women, especially at that time, they needed to be pretty, they needed to be able to attract, they needed to be smart, but not too smart, because they still needed to attract men. They had to find the right man, and if the right man didn't like them, you know, in our society, you seek out your own partners. And, you know, it was just this constant thing. And they were suffering so intently. But I realized something that was different between me and them. I wanted to find out what the method was for happiness, and I was willing to put out effort to change myself in order to have it. And everyone around me wanted to be happy, but anything that required shifting a little thought, taking up the experiment, beginning the practice, well, isn't there an easier way? Even still, now I've been doing what I'm doing here, I've been doing it for decades. And there was this, I lived for 30 years. I said I had 10 years in the forest, and then I got moved to Silicon Valley, where I now lived for more than 30 years. I mean, talk about a contrast. And we have a temple and a teaching center and a school and a community, a lot of things there. And I've had the same associates for decades. And there's this one very dear man, he's very dear to me, and he would come to all my classes for years and years and years. And he would ask lots of questions. And they'd always be complicated questions. And gradually I began to realize, no matter what he asked, he was always asking the same question. And the question was, you've said this, you've said that, Patanjali says this, Yogananda says this, Kriyananda says that. We're supposed to do this, we're supposed to do that. Isn't there an easier way? Isn't there a shortcut? I realized he was regarding me the way I had regarded my parents as a child, that there was some secret that at some point, if he just kept asking me often enough, I would tell him, isn't there an easier way? You know? We've put ourselves, by our own actions, we've created this complicated matrix of self-definitions which all have become very important to us, and we're attached to all of them, and we think all of them are essential to our happiness. And when even the idea comes that maybe we need to shift, one of my friends put it perfectly. She said, there's no point in even trying to change a habitude or an attitude until you're absolutely disgusted with it. Because it has to be that the suffering of the present situation looks like more suffering than the effort required to change it. And that's the difference in a very real sense between religion and spirituality. Religion says, you just follow these rules, you just do this, you talk to the priest, you get these ceremonies. And one of my friends in India told me, he said, Hindus are the only people in the world who pay someone else to practice their religion. You hire the priest and he'll do the mantras for you. You pay him to practice your religion. I thought it was a very insightful way to put it. But the fact of the matter is, you can't pay anyone to do it, and you can't... there's a comedian in America called Garrison Keillor, and he said, thinking that you can become a Christian by going to church every Sunday is like going and sitting in your garage and hoping to become a car. And they're very true, because it's not, religion is the form that results when people get a glimpse of the potential for self-transformation. And so when you understand self-transformation, you can look at those dogmas of religion, as Jamal was calling them, the ways of belief, and you can see that in their basis, they relate to the ways of awakening. But the way of awakening is a personal commitment. And it's a personal commitment to become more than we are. And we're driven by one thing. I want to avoid suffering, and I want to find more happiness. And no one will make that decision or that move. No one can do it for you. There's not one person who can force you to change your self-definition until it crosses your mind that this isn't working for me. But you see, the good news about all of this is, and this is how Krishna puts it in the Bhagavad Gita, even a little practice of this inward religion will free one from dire fears and colossal sufferings. Because we tend to think about things in absolute terms, and this is the shortcut. Even the tiniest bit of effort put out in the direction of where true happiness lies brings us much more than we could ever imagine could come to us. I think of it like, I've seen cartoons where you have something that, what they call a diving bell. I don't even know if they still have those things. I remember childhood cartoons that would involve somebody going into the deep in one of these little diving bells. Or they have movies nowadays, submarine movies, and you know at some point in the submarine movie, somebody's going to poke a hole in the submarine and all the ocean water is going to come, and then there'll be lots of scenes of people screaming and water coming in, you know, just like that. And finally they'll plug the holes, and that's how it'll work. Well, that image, I realized as I began to explore and try to bring into my life more of what I saw in Kriyananda, was I realized that the infinite power of the potential of our own nature, the potential for happiness, the potential for freedom, the potential for fearlessness, it's always trying to break through. It's really just like the ocean surrounding the submarine. And we work so hard, just work really hard, this incredible amount of tension and pressure, always to remain small and self-contained. You know, the universe, I'm a devotee, I can speak of God, I can speak of Divine Mother. Divine Mother is always trying to love us, and we're always curling ourselves up and trying to prevent it. As part of the ceremonies, one of the ceremonies that Swami Kriyananda wrote, it's called the Festival of Light. And in our temples, Ananda temples, we do this ceremony every Sunday. It's a little bit like the Catholic Mass, but it's not really. But as part of it, we have the Indian habit of people come up and receive the light of a candle. And some of us are called light bearers, which is the name of the book I've written. And we actually bless people at the spiritual eye. We take the light from the candle and bless. One of the children who grew up in our community now, Ananda itself is 50 years old, so children and babies have become adults. One of my friends, who's now a grown man, when he was a child, and his father would sometimes bring him up, and he would come toward me, and I would try to bless him, and the little baby, he would put both his hands over his forehead, just begin to scream at the top of his lungs, "No, no, no, no!" And he would struggle and struggle. You know, I mean, I thought it was so funny. You know, it was always a sort of an amusing point. And then the father would try to persuade the son that that is not the way to behave. But he reminded me so much of ourselves, isn't it so? You know, some force brings us up toward a greater sense of our own reality, and we feel that coming toward us. But at the same time that we're going to become something larger, we're going to also lose what was smaller. And we play this constant. And this is how God draws us to Him. And this is how our own soul draws us to a greater reality, is not by dogma, but by experience. This is how Jamal talks about it being science. You conduct the experiment. What would happen if? When I was first told about the idea of karma and reincarnation, what did I know about that given my upbringing? But I decided I would start looking at the world as if there was such a thing as karma, as if there was such a thing as reincarnation. And what would the world look like? I applied that as a template to circumstances I was looking at, and all of a sudden many mysteries were solved. It began to work for me. I remember once a man saying to me, just sort of like, he waited till I was completely in private, I'd been giving classes on this subject. He said, "Do you really believe that stuff?" Just like that. I said, "Yeah, actually I do. Because I've done the experiment." And so that's what we all have to do. That's what we're doing all the time. We have a choice of how to live. We either just blow with the wind, and just take whatever is coming and just hope that we don't crash and burn too terribly. But unfortunately, in this world, it's exceedingly insecure. You know, I'm old enough now to have watched people raise their children, see how the children turn out. I've seen all the high hopes that the parents have. I have multi-generational friendships, so I can see all the whole sides of it. Sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't quite work out so well, does it? But we all just still hope. But there's a point at which we don't just have to just hope. You know, there are living examples, there are methods, there are ways that we can be different. When I came to live at the Ananda Ashram back in 1971, I was there for one reason, and that was to learn from Swami Kriyananda. I just attached myself to him like a mollusk, or just like this. And fortunately, he responded to me. He recognized my sincerity, and I became his secretary, and I worked with him for a number of years. I thought I would do that forever, but it turned out not to be true. But immediately what I had intuited in that first, literally in that first moment that I saw him, was constantly confirmed by everyday contact with him. And believe me, his life was not easy. It wasn't, we have this idea that, oh, I'll get on the spiritual path and all difficulties will go away. Everybody will be nice to me from now on. Please, I'm so sorry to have to tell you, but it's not going to work. Even a little bit of this spiritual practice will save you from dire fears and colossal sufferings, but dire fears and colossal sufferings still keep coming knocking at the door. There's just another way to deal with it. And what I saw in the life of Swami Kriyananda was not a life freed from challenge, but someone who knew how to meet challenge head on, with courage, with tools, with faith, with energy, all of the things Jamal's talking about that Kriya practice gives you. And from very early on, I realized that I was a witness to something very unusual, that a man like this is not born in the world very often. A man like this is not born in the world very often. And Swami Kriyananda was one of his commissioned spiritual children who was to take what the Master put into the world and translate it into an actual way of life. That's why we had communities. That's why he wrote 150 books on all the subjects that people have to deal with. Raising children, educating children, making money, having ethics in business, how to be a creative artist. I want to speak of all the philosophical subjects, the Bhagavad Gita, the Bible, all these things. But he himself was the greatest teaching, which is, what do you do when your health breaks down, when your closest friends betray you, when you're constantly faced with money challenges, when people are dishonest in regard to you, when lawsuits are filed against you, when your reputation is destroyed in public. I mean, so that we begin to find that spiritual life is not a free ride, but it is the beacon of life that goes through it. And very early in my spiritual life, he said what I sort of already knew, but he put it into words, which is that you have to write my life. And he told me that when I was 24. I wrote it, I finished it just a little while ago. I mean, I finished the actual writing a little less than a year ago. It took a while to get it published. I worried about it every single day. There wasn't one day in my life after he told me that I wasn't anxious about the responsibility. But he'd said to me when I was 24, he said, I will help you. And finally, when I really sat down to write the book that we're launching today, he helped me. He told me what his life was for, and he gave me the words to be able to say it. Now, I'm here, I mean, I wouldn't be here anyway, the coincidence of having just published this book. But what we need in our lives is we need examples. Not only because those examples literally can teach us, but think about in your own life how the people who have more power than you do in the ways that you want to have it, whether it's your mother, your father, your friend, your spouse, your children, people who know what you're trying to learn and can give you some of what they have. I mean, this is how the world works. That's how it's organized. And this is why we, you know, advocate Yogananda's life. This is why all those who have learned these spiritual teachings have so much to teach us. You know, this world is a very, the word I want to use is lonely place. And whenever we find kindred spirits, whether they're still on the planet or whether their spirit is here even if their bodies are gone, those kindred spirits are really what carry us through, isn't that so? And that's what we're all hoping for with our families and our relatives. But sometimes your biological relationships are also your kindred spirits, and sometimes they're not. But whenever you're fortunate anywhere in your life to find anyone who lives in the world the way you want to live in the world, you know, that's a gift beyond measure. And when that comes to you, we have to open our hearts and accept the blessing, because that's the biggest gift from God. That's why every single day I thank God, because Swami walked into the room and I just knew who he was. And I knew what he meant to my life. And I've had a lot of ups and downs. I'm just like everyone else. I've had days that lasted forever. You know, long, long, sad days. I've had enough tears to fill quite a few buckets. But I always knew that I had divine friends. And some of my divine friends are my peers, and some of them are my teachers. But holding on and following that ray when it comes to you, that's what Krishna was talking about. That's what will save us. All of us want the same thing. It doesn't matter where we were born, what country, what it looks like. I've been riding around Singapore looking out the window trying to understand what's here. What's here is a whole lot like Palo Alto. What's here is a whole lot like Delhi. It's a whole lot like Bali and Chiang Mai, every place I've ever been in the world, Paris, because every sentient being wants to escape suffering and find happiness. And we can, you see. That's the great promise of this life, and we all know intuitively. You see, if we didn't know, if we didn't believe it was possible, we just give up. But we don't. And because we persevere, God opens doors. And if we have the courage and the willingness and the longing, we walk through them. So, God bless you all.
Thank you, Ashwaji, for that beautiful yet inspiring talk and sharing so many nuggets of your own life experience with people here. It was just beautiful. So we are now going to launch Ashwaji's book. This book has been in the making for 44 years. So like she mentioned during her talk, I think 1 or 2 years into her life, Swamiji was gave her this beautiful task of penning his life story down. That book, I did take a sneak peek in, just so that I can share some things with you. Because I was too curious and just wanted to know what was inside. Has beautiful spiritual nuggets. You see Swamiji, Swami Kriyananda, in the way of what a disciple or a disciple should be, in that she shares beautiful, that's the book, thanks Vanan for putting that up. So that book talks about insider information, if I may use that, of what his life was, of the spiritual teachings which come directly from Paramahansa Yogananda. So it's a beautiful, inspiring book, and I'd like to invite Ashwaji on stage, and also Yogi Ji. This is the first. Yogi doesn't like to come up at the forefront. He's usually someone who stays behind. But he is the reason why the center in Singapore exists, the Kriya Satsang Center in Singapore exists. He is the reason why most of us volunteers are here today as well. I remember seeing pictures on Facebook of him and a few other volunteers painting the walls of the center, so that's where we started from. So we would like Ashwaji to kindly present the book to Yogi Ji, and then
this is actually a new copy. This is a bit of a big ceremony for a book I've been selling in America for a month. But this is actually the copies printed in India because it was also published there. So it is my great pleasure. After all this time, having met you in the kitchen of the Gorgon Ashram all those years ago, to present this to you. I offer this to you with a profound and serious prayer that the spirit that is Swami Kriyananda will speak to you through these pages, that he will inhabit your heart, and that he will guide and bless you in all that you do. I actually have one more request on this. I've never raised children. I never had any of those 12 children that I plan to have. Not one. But this is my baby. And I have observed with my friends who they raise their children at a certain point. The child goes off and has a life that the parents don't witness and they don't know anything about, and they develop friends and experiences. And I mean, I worked hard on this book, but as soon as I finished it, I really felt like it wasn't mine anymore. Really not at all. It's partly because I felt like Swami wrote it through me, really honestly. But also, it just now has a life of its own. And that it's like, its mission is a very simple one. Is to awaken people to their own potential and to give them the opportunity to walk through that door into greater joy. So what I consider the point of this book is the prayers of all of you that whoever is destined to have their life uplifted by Swami Kriyananda, as I and countless others have, that somehow this book will find them and touch them and they can go forward, because we're all in this together. And so that would be what I would like to consider to be the launching of this book. Thank you.
So now we'll come to the question and answer segment. I'd like to invite Jamalji on stage. And if you have a question, you can raise your hand. We have volunteers around who can pass the mic to you or pass a little post-it for you to write your questions down. Yeah.
My name is Catherine. For the last 10 years, I've been battling with my addiction for alcohol. So I don't know how I've been going for meditation and all this for the last 10 years, but nothing seemed to work for me. So I was hoping today in the morning when I came, something would come up for me here today.
There are those who are very addicted to alcohol. And this comes from past lives, that we have done these particular things. And I hope there's no judgment in this room, because we all have different things that we get addicted to in other lives. And then in this lifetime, we come and we try to change that habit, because we're evolved enough now to know that it doesn't work, that we run up against a big wall, that we have a huge habit. But if you sincerely desire to break that habit, that it can be done. There are obviously 12-step programs, but the way that that program would work is that you are with other people who have magnetism, and you're with a group of friends, and the whole group of friends says, we don't want to do this anymore. And as a group, you will help be able to overcome that particular addiction. I don't want to take all the time on this, but I had a dream one time that I was drinking alcohol. I won't go into the details of this dream. It's interesting, but I don't have time. And then the next day, Swami Kriyananda actually was the most amazing being I ever met. He knew my thoughts, but beyond that, he even knew what I was dreaming. And he was giving a satsang one day, and he just looked at me, and he just said, "We don't have to worry about this anymore." And in that moment, it was well over drugs and alcohol at that time, they simply don't work. But in that moment, I felt that he had given me a blessing that I knew that would be lifelong and that would change me. And so the point that's trying to be made here is that there are human beings, whether you find them in a 12-step program or whether you find them on the spiritual path, but if you sincerely desire in your heart to change and you open yourself up to some power that's higher than you, that power can enter in and take charge of your life and give you the power to overcome those habits. Never identify yourself with any of your habits. You are not those habits. You are the soul, and the soul is stronger than those habits. So the most and the best that I can do today is give you hope. I promise you that you can overcome any addiction that you want to, if you will not only do it with your own will, but draw on a higher source, on a higher power, to come and strengthen your will. And it's up to you to figure out what that higher source is, what that higher power is. But don't worry. I promise you, you can do it, and you will do it.
Hi. I just want to raise this question on behalf of my wife. She's, by profession, she's a doctor. She has raised them, and in her life, so many friends she has made, but maybe she got cheated, never had a good friendship with them. So that experience stops her to make further relations, trust to the people, and those things in her life. So how she can overcome that experience she has got, because that influence somewhere affect the future relationships. So,
thanks. You know, when I was in my 44 years of knowing Swami Kriyananda and watching him, there was always a mystery about him that I could never quite understand, and I actually sincerely misunderstood it for many years. He was so open to people. He was so trusting, he was so giving of his heart, he just never protected himself at all. And yet many, many people betrayed him, and he had a lifelong life that escalated to literally 12 years of litigation, which is with his own gurubais. It was just like about as terrible as anything you could imagine. And yet he never closed his heart to anyone. I thought he didn't experience suffering in the same way that other people did. Because my way of dealing with suffering was to suppress my feelings. I just closed down, and I was aloof, and I was contracted, and I thought that was spiritual. So I thought that's what he was doing. And only very slowly did I realize that in fact his heart was far more tender than mine. And just as Jamal was saying, he could read people's thoughts. He could feel their consciousness even when they didn't speak. And he was aware of much more than I was. So his capacity to stay open was not because he didn't suffer. It was because he trusted, that's a very subtle point really, he trusted that the way to freedom that suffering teaches us, and that the way to freedom was to see that there's always a higher purpose and a plan, and that the only reason that we suffer is because we have attached ourselves to the wrong things. And when you attach yourself to people behaving a certain way and they don't behave that way, you suffer. As he put it really simple, if I ever believed in human nature, he said, I would have lost my faith a long time ago. He said, I believe in the presence of God acting through people for my own and everyone else's highest good. Now, is that easy? No, actually. It's really, really difficult, and speaking of what you were saying, that's why we anesthetize ourselves. But the fact is, sooner or later, we have to develop the courage to see what's real and then see beyond it. And the reason not to hold yourself closed in, it's really simple. The reason not to anesthetize yourself with drugs or drinking or sugar or television or whatever it might be, is because it doesn't work. It's really, really simple. It just doesn't work. It doesn't bring us what we think it's going to bring us. And when the experience of suffering is greater than the effort of changing, that's the point when we'll change. And no one can do that for you. But what you can do, both of your questions, you can work over here to have a bigger experience. So your fear of people here, the necessity to drink here, just put it aside and add positive into your life. And when you add positive in your life, it begins to give you positive experiences, which gradually contrast to those negative experiences. Swami said that to me once in a situation. He said, you've taken it as far as you can go. You need to just put it on a shelf now and develop yourself in other ways. And then you can circle back and deal with it. Which is sort of the philosophy I followed. If it's too big and it's going to defeat me, I run away and go train myself where I can. And then suddenly I turn back and I become bigger. And then I can make myself deal with it. Does that help?
Don't be shy. Any more questions? Yes.
Hi. In the second talk, you mentioned God a few times. So is it in a religious sense or something else?
I think we both should talk about this. I think I can speak for both of us to begin with, that both of us feel deeply a longing, a respect for God, but I'm also very sensitive to the fact that many people want nothing to do with God. That growing up in America, people told me that I must believe in the way they believe or I would burn forever in hell. Swami Kriyananda told us that finite cause can never have an infinite effect. And as soon as I heard that, okay, I don't know if the Christians are right or wrong, but at least that makes sense. A finite cause can never have an infinite effect. I personally like to let each person develop their own understanding, their own relationship with God. It's not something that I want to force upon anyone, that each person has to understand what does God mean to them. There was an atheist in Australia, and he loved what Swamiji said, but he told Swamiji, I'm an atheist, how can I process all of this? What do you have to say to me? And Swamiji said to him, why don't you think of God as the highest image of your own self that you can understand? Meaning that if you want to be more compassionate, more loving, more whatever, think of God as that. It's a beautiful understanding. But anyway, each person needs to have the freedom to approach God in his or her own way. Yet I do feel, at least for myself, that it's a vital part of life. Otherwise I look around this world and I just say, what is going on? How does this work? But if there's something higher that I have to relate to, then I have a direction that I can go. I want to say one more point on this, then I'll hand the microphone over. But in India, many people worship idols, I-D-O-L-S. And Christians, of course, will say, oh, hell and brimfire, terrible, that you can't worship idols, that it needs to just be abstract principles. Yet, of course, what is Christ on the cross? That's an idol that people put up in their home. And so, ignorance actually is 50-50. But what I really like to worship is ideals. That if Ram is an ideal, that I want to be like that particular man, or Krishna, or Jesus Christ, then I can't just, it's hard for me to worship something in an abstract way. If you're a scientist, you might love contemplating infinity and looking out at all the stars. But still, I want to have a picture up of all of those different galaxies so I can remember that I'm trying to expand my consciousness. Anyway, that's a long, long question that we could talk about. But at the end, I have to say that it's your own personal journey, and I deeply respect that.
And when we speak English and use the word God, it has absolutely no meaning if you think about it. And it really doesn't. It's a very non-specific word. Everybody gives it a meaning according to how they've been brought up, or, you know, positive or negative, according to the context, the theology that was defined. It has absolutely no meaning. And so a lot of people, when I would teach meditation courses and so on, they would come in and say, you know, believe in God. And I would say, well, I probably don't believe in the God that you have rejected either. because it's some concept that simply doesn't make any sense to you. And with all due respect, or without that respect, a lot of people's concept of God is not attractive, not even slightly. And so any thinking person would naturally reject it. So what you have to think about, and not think of it like this, when I'm trying to use non-words that will not cause nobody to react, you know, life is an expansion of awareness. Kavita has a little boy who's 3 years old, and he was following us around a lot yesterday. We were following him, actually. And he was in a constant, unrelenting, you might almost call it a desperate request, to find out what everything in the world is, period. And we went to the beautiful orchid garden that you have here, and there were some fountains like this, and it was a hot day. I like water. I just put my hands in the water. So Kester picked him up and carried him to the water, and he was sort of going to touch the water, but then, like, no, he didn't want to touch the water. And I realized he's 3 years old. The water is moving. It's making a lot of noise. As far as he was concerned, I mean, it could have jumped off of the fountain and consumed him at any moment. The awareness that water is inert, that it's not going to move, that it's harmless. I mean, these are huge awarenesses that a three-year-old child didn't have. It was just a moving object that might hurt him. So he would, you know, cluster up, but he really wasn't going to go into that water for anything at all. But he will gradually expand his awareness, and he will learn, you know, many things about the nature of this world. Well, it's an inward expansion, too. We gradually learn where happiness comes from, what causes us suffering, what pleasure is, what pain is. I mean, all the things that we learn. Everything that you learn is an expansion of awareness. You know, Jace was trying to learn to use a spoon to pick up the rice and then find his mouth, you know. And sometimes he found his mouth, and sometimes he found some other part of himself, you know. But gradually he would develop the awareness every time. So, I mean, I didn't think of it. I just put rice on my spoon and put it in my mouth. But I didn't always know that. So what I think is the most helpful way in terms of God is don't be an atheist or an agnostic or a blind believer. Be a truth seeker. And just ask yourself what's true. And don't get stuck on vocabulary, because we hardly ever know what we're really saying to each other anyway. So just ask yourself, can I know more than I presently know? Because if you put an end point on it and say, this isn't true, then you have just defined yourself, and you get to stay exactly as you are. Like, is that such a treat? Is that something that we want to defend? So you can claim what you do know, because if you're an intelligent thinking person, you have a right to claim what you do know. But you also have to have the humility to recognize, there might be things I don't know. I'll tell you one small funny story on this, and then I'll give it back. When I first came to Ananda Village, which is the ashram I lived into, there was this man there, his name was Binay, and he had developed, we had nothing, we had no buildings, no nothing, and he had built this little, he was making jewelry out of bits of wood and wildflowers that he gathered, and he had his little shop in this old abandoned van that had just been resting on the property. So he put his little business inside of this, that some other person decided it was an eyesore, pulled the whole thing off and pushed it over the cliff into the dump somewhere. So I hear him saying, Mother, he's speaking of Divine Mother, but I've never heard it like that. Mother inspired me to make this business, but then Mother took it away from me. I guess Mother wants me to do something else, I think. Because in America we're not so, you don't stay with our parents after we grow up. I think he's pretty old to just be doing what his mother wants him to do. It seemed really weird to me. And then when I heard he was actually talking about God, it was so strange I didn't have any idea what to do with it. Absolutely none. It was just the strangest thing I'd ever heard. Then I say something to Swamiji about a difficulty I have, and Swami so lovingly says to me, just give it to Divine Mother. And I just stared at him like, and? You know, like, and what am I supposed to do? It was just, again, it was just crazy to me. But I was trapped, because I knew that Swami Kriyananda knew more than I did. And so even if he seemed completely nuts to me, and I had any idea what to do with it, I couldn't reject it. Because I had faith in my own understanding, but enough humility to know I didn't know everything. 7 years later, some girl comes up to me, she has this terrible problem. I say, just give it to Divine Mother. She looks at me with an expression I recognize. Anyway, that's the story.
Next question.
Yes. Hello everyone, this is Deepthi. First of all, I have to thank everyone for giving me this such opportunity, especially in Singapore. Thank you, and I'm very blessed to meet you and all, because you are having 50 years of, it's not an easy thing. And the main inspiration for me to come in is my mother, who practices yoga and meditation, and my uncle. And I strongly believe, sorry if I'm taking this, I just want to share my experience. I recently given birth to a small little girl. During that time, I was working as a software engineer. And I have gone through some videos, and somewhere I felt that I have to go to this path which benefits my baby too. And in such a way that I was so into my job, I left the job and I went back to India. And I got my uncle and my mother, I got so many of teachings regarding this yoga and meditation. And I have got the book of Guruji also. And I'm just starting this, but somewhere I feel that many people say that there is a karma. There's a believers of karma that brings us to this path. Do we need to really believe this, or shall we just go forward what we believe?
Sure, you don't have to believe in karma. It's still going to be there, whether you believe in it or not. You can believe in gravity or not believe in gravity, but it's a law in the universe which holds things together. But I would suggest that you put together a set of beliefs that work for you, and then carry on accordingly, but at the same time, never be afraid to look at those system of beliefs. Never be afraid to question them and ask, is it working? As you walk on this path or any other path, in the beginning, it's quite right to take a look and look at each set of the beliefs and say, do I really believe this? Do I really believe this? And sometimes, as Ashaji was saying, in Autobiography of a Yogi, someone's meditating, you just, or whatever, they're dematerializing as well, page 8, you just have no idea what to do with that, and you don't know if you can believe it, because it's outside of the boundary line, or the horizon of our own experience. Yet, as I've grown spiritually, that I've seen, well, Paramahansa Yogananda said this, and he said this, and he said this, and yes, I've had this experience, yes, I've had this, yes, I've had this. He said that I haven't had this one yet, but because of all of the past experience, I can say, I think then that I choose to believe him, and I want to continue to grow. I want my own understanding to continue to grow so that I understand how these things work. Also, don't be afraid to sit down and analyze something like karma deeply within your own self, that you're much smarter, all of us, than we know. That we don't always have to rely on some outside authority to tell us it is like this or it isn't. We can simply just sit down in silence and think life through. Think, ask questions of, why do I have some particular habit, even though I wasn't born in that society that has that habit, or whatever the case may be. And we start thinking about who we truly are and why we are the way that we are. And then we begin, some of these things make sense.
Why especially I want to ask this is, I want to make this as a habit in my lifestyle. And I don't want to get deviate from this. So I think the same question many of us are having it. Because sometimes we think that, okay, tomorrow morning I have to wake up and do the yoga or meditation. But sometimes some obstacle comes in the life, we can't follow it. So is there anything that we can do so that we can make a part of it?
I think you're asking the same question my friend asked. Is there a shortcut?